So I know I am all, or I guess we are all, that stands between you and a cocktail. So we will try and, or I will do my best to make it lively and fun, and I hope interactive. We have a small group, so please feel free to maybe ask clarifying questions and things like that along the way, should you want to. I'm delighted to be presenting for our team today, and we have a few of our team members are here, Carrie Thatcher and Jeannie Ng and Alex Lightfoot. So it's great to have them here, and they can chime in and give their perspectives as well. So let's see. Organized here. We do have this very big research group. And part of our task today is to tell you a little bit about how that research group functions and how we do what we've been doing over the last year and a half. We have folks from many, many disciplines represented, as you can see, and we're going to talk about that, as well as community organizations, and we're going to talk about that as we go on. So, but first, I want you to tell you a little bit about why we do what we do. And what we're hoping to make a dent in over time is health disparities facing Latino youth. There are a lot of them in a lot of different areas, and there's also ample evidence that Latino patients experience discrimination in the healthcare environment. I don't know whether all of you are close enough to read these, so I'll read a few things out. Or can you see them? Is that better? Okay, it's gone away. So just a few things to point out here. Patient experiences with medical care during pregnancy found that low-income Black and Latino women were more likely to report being encouraged to limit their family size than middle-class whites. In the family planning context, evidence that minority and low SES women experience disparities in care, Black and Hispanic women, women with lower levels of education, having been found to rate their family planning visits less positively, and also finding that Hispanic women were more likely to be counseled about sterilization. And of course, the unequal treatment report brings into play this notion of implicit bias. And so our focus on health disparities comes through the lens of, can we do something about implicit bias that perhaps leads physicians in particular to behave in ways that are inconsistent with what they might state that they want to do for their patients of color. So if we're going to talk about implicit attitudes and implicit bias, we should just get on the same page about what that means. So they are evaluations that come spontaneously to mind, and they have the potential to influence behavior unintentionally. We want to contrast that with explicit attitudes, which is what I say about how I feel about my Latina patients, how I want to interact with them, what I believe about what kind of care people deserve. Okay. So as much as we want to focus on Latino youth, we also are wanting to give things to another group of folks that are pretty highly stressed, and that is providers. There is ample evidence that healthcare providers consider themselves to be under a lot of stress. So data from 2011 shows that 15 to 75% of physicians rate themselves as under severe stress. And if that's the statistic, then that means that there's some group that rate themselves as moderately stressed. So all in all, these folks in the healthcare environment are in a position where implicit thinking, fast thinking, can influence them more than other people. Because it's when we're under stress that people, this is what I was afraid was going to happen, when we're under stress that people begin to use those shortcuts to get and engage in behavior that they perhaps otherwise wouldn't if they had time to slow down. So in order to address this, we did bring together a very big multidisciplinary team. And we were responding to a call from the NIH and the National Endowment for the Arts, which asked us to use the arts to address issues related to culture and health. So I'm just going to let this come up because it's not doing what I wanted it to do. So this is our team, and these are all of the many disciplines represented. So we have folks from public health, from social work, from art history, from social psychology, from medicine, and from photojournalism. And when I think about the interdisciplinary aspect, which is really the focus of this presentation, it occurred to me upon reflection that I don't think we talk a lot about disciplines in our team or our disciplinary lenses. But we do talk, I think, about our shared values and things we have in common. And that's what these smaller things are that I've inserted into this slide. So all of us sort of care about the arts and about the humanities and about their power to do perhaps more than they do sitting over in the College of Arts and Sciences and putting them to work. In particular, we care about pictures and how images can help us think differently and have different conversations. All of us care about social justice and about equity. That's why we're all here. Many of us have worked in community partnerships in different ways for a long time. We have a lot of CBPR experts on our team, although not all of us would claim that expertise. But many of us have worked in community partnerships outside of the academy for a long time. We are all, in many ways, linked to healthcare. Prior to coming into the academy, most of my work was in critical care settings in healthcare. So I have a real affinity for people that do that work, and as well as, you know, Jeannie is working with hospitals all over the place, Jeannie and Alex. So there are lots of us that have connections to medical care in addition to our physician team member. So we have three specific aims, but the one that I'm really going to focus on is this one today, where we're focusing on our visual intervention that we've been creating to combat implicit bias. It is a two-part intervention that we call Yoveo Salud. And I'll talk more about that. So the first part centers on a series of images taken by an award-winning photojournalist, Janet Jarman. And Janet is a UNC graduate, and she has followed a young girl from the age of 8, starting in about 1996, until the present. So she's been following her all of this time and her family as she has migrated from Matamoros, Mexico, into the United States. So her pictures have documented that journey. We have taken those pictures and interspersed additional data with them to create a training experience for residents. It's a two-hour, very open-ended conversation. We're presenting particular parts of this young girl's story, and then we intersperse data with that that talks about Latino youth experiences more generally with school and with healthcare and with other dimensions of their life. We believe that that acts as sort of a priming experience for the second part of the intervention. And the second part is an experience with Photo Voice, where we have had two groups of Latino youth who have been taking photographs about their life, answering the question, what do I want my doctor to know about my life? So they took a series of photographs, went through the entire Photo Voice process, and those findings were wonderfully presented yesterday morning by Alex and our community partner, Florence Simon. And that culminates in a forum where the youth and the residents are together looking at their pictures, looking at the youth's pictures, and hearing from the youth directly. It was a terrific event. You can see we had about probably 20-plus folks from the medical side together with, how many youth was it? 12 youth who were presenting their work. So in order to talk about how this team functions, you need to know a little bit about our research design. So it is a post-test only cohort control design. So we have a control condition and an intervention condition with a group of residents. And the timing is important because our control condition had to happen at a particular moment in order to get those people in the control condition and to protect against any kind of contamination influences for this group that were going to come in as first-year residents. So that meant that we had to have something going on like this. And gears have sort of been my central motif, or is it motif or metaphor? I need my humanities folks. metaphor for how these... how this project has worked, because each piece has to move so that the others can move, and we can't really have anything sort of gumming up the works. So the second presentation is about measurement design, and that was really a very critical piece and sort of started everything else moving. So, back to this question, the central question of how does this interdisciplinary team work? And I really do think that it has been a kind of a nice thing to sit and reflect on this in preparing for the presentation, because again, I really don't think it's about the disciplinary boundaries very much at all. We have had next to no conversation about that. Our colleague from comparative literature represented us this summer at a small working group that some folks at the NIH called together. And he said that everybody wanted to know about the interdisciplinary aspect. And he told them that he just didn't think it was an issue at all. And one thing that he brought up that we did that he thought promoted that was an exercise that we start all of our full group meetings with. And we do have regular full group meetings that happen about every 2 or 3 months, where we set aside 5 hours and we're all together, and people are really fantastic about prioritizing that. So that gives us a little bit of space, but isn't apparently too overwhelming for people to be able to make that commitment. So we start those, we start with an image for each of those meetings, where we ask people, give everybody a prompt, ask people to bring an image that responds to that prompt. And those prompts are about what's important to us as sort of individuals and as professionals. They're about values that are important to us. And I think that sort of sets a tone for the group. They're not in any particular order. I mix them up very consciously, so it doesn't necessarily privilege students over faculty, over consultants, over community partners. So it can be a real mix as to who starts out the conversation. So that's been something that has been helpful. We've also had a number of shared experiences that aren't necessarily related directly to our work. We went to communications training together. We just to learn how to be better public speakers, sort of just a team investment, thinking that maybe over time that will be useful to all of us in a lot of different ways. When Janet's been in town, we've asked her sometimes to show us her current work, whatever she's working on, current photographs. So those have been the things that we've done. As the putative leader of this team, I try to say yes whenever I can to whatever the request is. If it's something about money, we try and do it. If it's something about the way a particular event needs to be organized, we try and do that too. And what gets in the way, I mean, not a lot has gotten in the way because we've really accomplished all of this, but I would say that we are all leaders on this team. You know, nobody gets to be a PhD, nobody's in a PhD program, nobody is running an organization without a capacity for leadership. And so, you know, when you have a bunch of strong-willed leaders in the room, people are going to have their points of view and have their ways of working. And so when that happens, I think what we've tried to do is just remember to communicate about it, remember that we're all acting out of goodwill, stay focused on the work, and just be good in our communication. So there's probably a lot that I've left out, and that's probably went really fast, didn't it? How have you? Okay, great. All right. So did you want me to do questions now, or? I think that's a, yep, that's out for that one. Is there anything anybody wants to bring up at the moment? These are pediatric residents? Mm-hmm. Yes. Anything else right now? Okay. Well, here's the hard part. So I'm going to be presenting for our colleague Keith Payne, who is a social psychologist, and I'm not a social psychologist. So I'm going to do my very best to channel him. So, and I should have said earlier, I don't have anything to disclose for this presentation or for the previous presentation. So we have our same great team, and we're going to focus in this presentation on measures in particular. So, and that will lead me to talk a little bit about the theoretical constructs that we are using. So we have... Ignore what's up here for a minute, and then we'll get back there. So we have three sort of theoretical perspectives that are influencing what we're doing. The first is the social intuitionist model, which is comes out of social psychology and talks about these sort of implicit attitudes that we have and how our quick thinking really drives a lot of what we say and do, more so than our rational brain. So that's the first, and it really focuses on the group nature of that. That so, as a when we talk as in our in groups, we're surrounded most of the time by people that think like us. So that reinforces that loop. So that's one. The second is this idea of transportability, coming out of public health, that really focuses on narrative. And when I get involved in a narrative, and I meet a character who smokes. And if I can identify with that character, then maybe I think it's okay to smoke. So that's the notion of transportability, and so hold that in mind. And then the third relates to how people either do or do not engage with a particular work of art. It comes out of visual studies, and it's about visual dissonance. So we use that. But what we're doing with all three of these things is we're sort of flipping it, because each of these sort of explain problem behavior, and we're trying to say, let's flip that to use these theoretical perspectives and the logic that's embedded within them to make positive change instead of just explain problematic kinds of behavior. So our study measures, we have explicit measures, and those are here. Things that we have: measure of ethnocultural empathy, an empathic healthcare orientation, and patient-centeredness. We ended up not doing case vignettes. And then we have a scale of transportability, so wondering if you could have a baseline characteristic of transportability, that it makes it easier for me to engage with a narrative, or I could we can also measure, does this particular experience allow me to be transported? So we're really measuring both. And then we are measuring implicit bias, and we're using Keith's affect misattribution procedure that has had to be completely modified for this particular study. So when you think about implicit attitudes, this notion of cognitive accessibility is kind of the starting point. So let's play a little game together. Please complete this word out loud. Yes, okay. And what if I do this? Now complete the word. Aren't you going to do it?
Yeah.
Nobody? Okay. You don't want to. But we all, okay, so we would complete the word if we did it split second and people were willing to engage in the game, which you're not. we would probably complete it with terrorists, given the current context. So that's where we start with implicit kinds of attitudes. Now, the most famous sort of way to test implicit bias is the implicit association test. How many of you are familiar with the implicit association test? Okay. Two or three of you. A little bit, you've heard of it. Anybody can go to the Harvard website and try it out, and you can look at your implicit attitudes on any number of things. It ranges from how you think about whether psychotherapy versus medicine is most effective, and about racial and ethnic attitudes. So I'm just going to give you a little sense of what this test is like. So I don't expect you all to do this. I'm just going to talk you through it. Okay? So, but if we started, we might start by clapping the right knee for arts and the left knee for science. And if I did that and I said, what is physics? You would clap your left knee for science, right? Okay. So then we do the same for music, and we do this kind of faster and faster, and we'd be able to make that match. But then we're going to add in another dimension. So now we're going to switch, and we're going to clap the right knee for male and the left knee for female, and we're going to see male and female names. And so we're going to do the same thing. So James, we're going to clap male, Thomas male, Henry male, Elizabeth female, etc. Okay. And then we're going to try and combine them. Okay, so we're going to see a name, and we're going to have to tap our knee, the correct knee, if we see one or the other of each of these things, so science or female. And when we try and do this fast, it becomes a little tricky, right? So here we see Elizabeth, and maybe we want to go to female, but we see that science, and we might go over there to male if we have sort of an implicit idea that girls or women go with arts and men go with science. So we can click on through. And then we switch it around again. We'll do it that way. And if we try then again to change our left and our right and do the same thing, we get even more, we get more into the IAT folks say the implicit. So if we had more time, we could do that. So when the IAT folks work with racial bias, this is what they find, is that they will find 70% of people, of respondents, showing pro-white bias. But the IAT has critics. It's not the only game in town. And what can you imagine might be a critique? Except that they're up there. I can't even ask that question. Okay. So there is this idea that some of us are better at task switching, and that is one big thing that the IAT requires, is that you are switching tasks very quickly. So if I tried to get you to match the color blue with girl and the color orange with boy and red wagon and something else, you know, these could be completely neutral things, and you might still have difficulty switching these tasks in such a way. So that's been one thing that Keith has tried to address with his measure. So the affect misattribution procedure works in a more simple fashion. And essentially what it does is it's showing you a picture back here, and then a neutral stimulus for most of us, and that is the Chinese character, unless, of course, you read Chinese characters. So, and then a blank screen. The instructions are pay no attention to the picture and tell me what this neutral stimulus means. Does it mean pleasant or unpleasant? In this case, pleasant or unpleasant. So it looks, it kind of works something like this. That fast. And then you're asked, is that pleasant or unpleasant? Here's another one. Pleasant versus unpleasant. Yeah. So I can even see around the room. People are smiling in response to some, so I could measure your pleasant versus unpleasant right there. And just a couple more. And so he has demonstrated that this same sort of thing can describe implicit attitudes with regard to race. one of his big studies was looking at voting behavior, so that implicit attitudes can really influence voting behavior. And both implicit and explicit attitudes are were explaining significant portions of the variance over and above party affiliation, whether you described yourself as conservative or liberal, race, gender, age, and education and income. So, but the problem is you remember that first slide about the AMP, that was an African-American male face, right? Just a face. And so for Latinos, you don't get the same effect from just the face. For Latinos, the effect seems to be much more contextual. It seems to be more about social class, might be about migration status, documentation status, all sorts of other pieces of the puzzle. So that's where, when Keith joined our team, that's where we started. He was saying, we don't have a measure for Latinos. So, in addition, we were thinking, well, is it just pleasant or unpleasant that we want to measure? That seems to be the most common thing. There are other dimensions in the healthcare environment that are really quite salient. So things like compliant, non-compliant, risky, safe, those kinds of dimensions. So we needed to make some decisions and test some things out. And so we did that through a series of cognitive interviews. We went to our local community health center. They agreed to, their physicians sat down with us. And we asked them about these descriptor pairs in particular. That's where we started. And asked them these questions: what comes to your mind when you hear the term responsible and all of the other pairs that are back there? We went through this with each term. And whether those terms were used in the healthcare environment, whether they thought they were appropriate. And then if there was anything else that we were missing. And based on those cognitive interviews, we narrowed down to these pairs of things that we were going to be testing. Then we had to think about pictures. What pictures were going to be used as the pairs? And this took, our big team has operated in sort of small hubs, each its own little gear in some ways. And everybody was invited to be included on whatever team they were interested in, and they could pick more than one if they wanted to. But there was a smaller group of folks that was working in particular on the measurement piece. So we started looking for pairs that would give a context and sort of connote one ethnic group over another and would match in other ways. So we didn't want things that were too, we wanted them to match as much as possible, except for that ethnic component. So we found pictures like this and like this and tried to match those up. Okay, so then we had to test them. And the way that you do this, which is absolutely fascinating, apparently you can go through Amazon through a procedure called MTurk, and you can ask people, pay them a dollar or something like that to test your measures. And so we looked at whether these photographs did what we hoped they would do. We came up with data like this. So you can see for this one, you're getting the desired effect on pleasant, unpleasant, and on compliant, non-compliant, and you're approaching significance on irresponsible, responsible. So this is a good pair to use based on that. Here, you're getting the effect on pleasant, unpleasant, and on honest, dishonest. So these are sort of two groups of working men. 1 minute. Eek. Okay. And, but this one, you get the effect on responsible and risky, not on the other dimensions. Here, everybody likes farmers. We're hardly getting any effect at all. So this pair went out. Again, here, people seem to like pregnant moms, no effect. And here, also taking care of the kids, no effect, or next to no effect. Again, a little bit close. here only on responsible versus irresponsible. And so we went through this in lots of different domains in order to get these images right. So I'm told I just have a few minutes left. This one can't get the effect. It's too busy. So there was a lot that went into this. This, you have two really attractive people, no effect whatsoever. So even though they're a good match, no effect. This one, oddly enough, you get the effect on criminal versus law-abiding. Now, this is in the general population. This is not with our residents at this point. So that becomes our overview, and so this helped us decide both which images to use and also which pairs of dimensions to pilot, so or to use in our pilot test. And so at this point, where we are is we have we've administered all of these measures to our control group. We're currently administering them to the treatment group, and hopefully we will have information to share with you next year, so stay tuned.